Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush. Charles W. Chuck Bryant here in the studio at Pond City Market, along with Noel.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning. The Roz to my Frasier. It is morning.
Just a peek behind the curtain.
Yeah, so far we've recorded these kind of first thing in the morning, which is, I'm not used to that.
I kind of like it. I'm a little bit fresher in the morning than I am later in the day sometimes.
You know? We are not nearly as stoned.
That's true.
Just a little bit. Yeah. Kidding, everyone, of course. So welcome to Mini Crush number 3. Judging from the feedback on Facebook and Twitter, you guys are liking these, which that just delights me to no end, because the whole idea was to do something fan-centric. And we are super glad. And the decision to get Noel on the mic was almost last minute. And I think it's key. So I'm just not here talking to myself like a goober.
I think you pull it off, you know, but it's nice to have a human to bounce things off of. And I'm honored to be your bouncing platform.
Well, you're as close to a human as we're going to get.
Yeah. So that's the nicest thing anyone said to me all week.
And if you don't know yet, go to the Facebook page, like it, because that is where you are going to be interacting with this show with your remarks and your, when I throw out questions and stuff. And it's really kind of one of the most fun parts of this job so far. I tell you what is the least fun is booking guests. That is no fun. I had someone wrote in the other day. It was like, I really think you should have someone like this and someone like this and like a Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Cool.
And I was like, yeah, I would love that.
Get them for me.
Yeah, go get them for me. That'd be great. All right. I'm going to do a couple of corrections here. Not corrections, just additions to past shows. And feel free to write in with corrections, but these are my own. When we were talking about digital versus film, and I was talking about my friend Scotty, the cinematographer, who was talking about how a lot of not-so-talented directors these days will just set up a ton of cameras and shoot everything. They call that spray and pray. That's the lingo.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and that makes sense. So he said, yeah, you should clear that up. Also, I mentioned when I was talking about Hal Hartley, the sad story of Adrienne Shelley, and I mentioned, you know, because she was murdered in her apartment in New York, that she was – in the movie Waitress, true, so not quite a correction, but I want to give full credit. Adrienne Shelley wrote and directed and starred and produced in Waitress. So that was her creation, and we want to give her, because, you know, especially at that time, there you don't see a lot of women writing and directing and producing and starring in their own movies.
And that is the source material for the hit Broadway show that's big right now?
Which I am almost positive was after her death.
I think so. I mean, it was in the last handful of years.
She was murdered, I looked up, I think 11 or 12 years ago.
Gotcha.
So it's a very sad story. I looked into that crime, and it was I'm not sure if I said it on the last show, but he was a worker, a undocumented Guatemalan construction worker. And the story changed a few times from this guy. He said that she came down and they got into an argument because of the noise, and she hit him, and he hit her, and she died, and he freaked out, and then took her upstairs and made it look like she had been hanged in her shower.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, which is what they initially thought. Like, they're like, you know, she died from throat asphyxiation. Is that the word?
I think it is.
And the husband was like, no way. Like, she definitely did not kill herself. She was not – I mean, it was one of those where there was like literally there wasn't even a hint of anything going on. She had a young daughter, and the story changed such to where we eventually find out that he went into her, he kind of stalked out the apartment in her, went in to rob her, and she caught him red-handed, and he hit her, and I think he thought she was dead, and very sadly, she was probably still alive, they think, when he made it look like she was being hanged, and she ended up dying because of being hanged in her shower.
Good Lord.
I know.
That's rough.
But the husband has now come out as a big criminal, advocate, but the opposite of advocacy.
Yeah, well, like victim advocacy, I guess.
Victim advocacy. Sorry. Like I said, it's morning. But also at the same time, as an advocate for not not running the story that, hey, this is the what's important here is that this guy was an undocumented immigrant. He doesn't want that narrative to be used, because he said it doesn't matter that he was undocumented. What matters that this guy was a cold-blooded killer.
Oh, absolutely. That really is a problematic way to tell that story. And it's a way that could be like jumped on by folks that are trying to speak out against immigration. Yes. And that's just,
and it has been
totally irrelevant. Totally irrelevant.
Quickly setting up the Oscar shows. Most of you know by now, I'm going to do a pre-Oscars and post-Oscar show over some red wine with Emily, my wife, at home after we put the kid to bed. And those are going to be pretty fun. So look for those coming up. And this week, segment one, go ahead and get into it with another social studies.
Social studies with Charles W. Chuck Bryant.
So, social studies, the question I threw out this week on Facebook, actually it was a few weeks ago, but you know how that goes. What was the first movie to legitimately make you scared long after it was over? I had to think about this one. And my answer is a bit of a cop-out in that I could not remember a specific movie. Although I'm sure it's happened. But I am going to go with the combo of Exorcist and Omen before I saw them. When you grow up, like everyone knows I did, when you grow up a little Southern Baptist boy, there is no scarier boogeyman on planet Earth than Satan.
I was going to say Jesus.
Well, yeah, that comes later. Then the devil himself. And I remember I was a little kid when those came out, so I was just the right age to really have a lot of fear in me about that. And I just remember seeing the previews and the trailers for the Antichrist Omen Kid and The Exorcist. And those movies, without seeing them, stayed with me. And that was part of it, is the unknown. But I was scared for a year straight, probably, around the release of those movies. And I don't even remember when I saw them. It was much, much later. And they're, you know, pretty legit scary movies.
Dude, the trailer for The Exorcist is fucking horrifying.
It is horrifying.
It's got that white face that kind of like twitches around.
Yeah.
It's like the demon or like the possessed version of whatever.
Twitchy faces.
Oh, man. It's not good.
That'll do it. Do you have one, Noel?
Well, I have two. The one that I remember keeping me awake at night was the horrible TV version of It.
Okay.
Just because the clown and like weird stuff happening to kids and all that. Like, I just remember legitimately having nightmares and being laying awake in bed being scared about that. But a movie that I had no business seeing at the age I saw it was Pet Sematary.
Yeah, man. That movie was scary.
Dude, it's not only scary, it's utterly mean-spirited and nasty, and nothing good happens to any of those characters.
Yeah. I remember being really scared at that one.
There's the sister, Zelda, that's all, like, skinny. It's actually a man, like a really tall, gangly man that's playing a woman.
Oh,
and
God.
She's like, I'll twist your spine.
Yes.
Like, oh, my God. That ruined me.
Yeah, that one freaked me out, and they shot that near my house. I don't know about all of it, but parts of it they shot at Well, you know Stone Mountain here.
Yeah.
There's also Panola Mountain, which is out toward where I grew up in Redan, suburban DeKalb County. And that's part of the same granite slab as Stone Mountain. But there's a big area where they shot Pet Sematary, where these big, like, granite outcroppings.
Okay.
And it was near me, so I remember being scared and being like, I'm not – because we used to go – like play around and hike over there sometimes.
I'd be interested to see what parts were shot there. I wonder if it was the house or if it was the actual
cemetery
stuff. Or
I can't remember. It's been so long.
No, I don't know. But like, yeah, I can't imagine knowing that any of that was shot anywhere near where I live. But that was a bad one for me, yeah.
Well, and I was still at the age where it's like they shot that there, didn't – there was no like, oh, neat, a movie was shot there. It was like, no, that happened there.
Yes.
You know?
That's the spot.
All right. So let's get through some of these. Boy, there's a lot of them. So I'll get to as many as I can. Mitchell Page. First Blair Witch Project from the 90s, because my younger self foolishly believed it was real when I saw it. Mitchell, don't feel bad, because that was the whole point. I remember the getting hip to that viral campaign way early on and seeing the trailer and the internet stuff and thinking either that this was real or this is one of the most revolutionary like marketing campaigns in movie history. It turned out to be number two. Eric Knight. Oh, man, I have a couple, but I'm going to say Fire in the Sky, because the movie I was terrified of being abducted by aliens. The scene where he's in zero gravity and breaks through that pod and lands in the middle of the decaying body. Nope, nope, nope. That's a good one. Melissa Lynn also says Fire in the Sky. She saw it when she was 7 years old, lived in northwest Georgia amongst the tall, tall pine trees. Okay, that makes sense. Scott Stevens, the original Jurassic Park, really stayed with him. Like most kids in the early 90s, I was dinosaur mad and thought the movie would be the coolest thing ever. Finally saw it, and it scared me out of my mind. Melanie Kaufman, The Descent. That movie was pretty scary.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard good things from horror buffs, yeah, friends of mine.
It was good. I couldn't sleep that night without music playing and a light on. I was a tad claustrophobic only for a year or two after, but you will never, never convince me to go spelunking. I actually went spelunking once, Melanie, and it was awesome, 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 and a little creepy.
Is that where you rappel, like down the side of a cliff or something? Or
no, that's just rappelling.
Okay.
Spelunking is caving.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Going into the belly of the earth.
I see.
Yeah, it's a little unsettling, trust me, because you get the feeling that, like, I could die down here.
And it's such a silly word for such a scary-sounding thing, yeah.
Well, people also call it caving. Okay. Amber Robertson, first movie that scared me was Alien. Here's the setup. We watched on what I assume was VHS, my aunt and uncle in the wood-paneled, blue shag-carpeted rec room of our basement. I'm the same age as you. So that means you're old as hell. Debbie Ronka, my friend, The Shining. Debbie, I did not know that this movie stayed with you, but that doesn't surprise me about you. My parent went out for the evening and told me, my parents, I know your parents. They went out for the evening and told me I could watch anything on television except for The Shining. So, of course, I watched it. That is so you. I was terrified and couldn't sleep for 2 days. Also, couldn't admit to my parents why I was afraid to go to sleep. Ah, that is also so you. I love that, Debbie. And I'm glad you're listening. Nathan David, the first Paranormal Activity movie, is the only movie to truly scare me to the point of running inside and shutting the door behind me.
My girlfriend, that's hers. She said she totally eye-rolled about it going in, but then it, like, freaked her out to the point of behaving in a certain way after it was over.
Yeah, there's something about a movie that literally makes your bedroom the scary place, right, and going to sleep scary. That's because that's supposed to be your safe place. Well done. Paranormal Activity. I think I saw that first one, but none of the other ones.
There's like nine of them or something, I think.
Keep that cash train rolling.
Got to.
Laura Dickinson, The Hills Have Eyes. Yeah, that's a good one. I went home after seeing it at a friend's house, but I was home alone and freaked out and had to call my friend's mom to pick me back up because I didn't know when my parents would come home. That is very sweet. Jesse Kidder, Silent Hill. Never saw it. But that video game is scary. The siren used in the movies is very similar as many weather sirens around here. It's not often that I hear it, but every time I do, I'm immediately taken back to Silent Hill, and it's terrifyingly awesome. Jody Neville, Jody's around on the page a lot. I think for me it was The Creeping Flesh. Did not see this one, an old British movie starring Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee. Well, Christopher Lee is, that's all you need to say. Very scary looking dude.
I bet this is one our buddies Joe McCormick and Robert Lamb over at Stuff to Blow Your Mind would know about. They're buffs of the older schlocky weird horror.
Yeah, I'm trying to see. I bet you Robert has a comment in here. Let's see here. Brendan Majeski, Twilight Zone the movie. Oh, you know what, dude? That one scared me afterward because I was the perfect age to be creeped out by that movie.
Isn't that the one where like a bunch of people died in the production, like a helicopter accident or something like that?
Yeah, three people died. Vic Morrow, Jennifer Jason Leigh's father, died on a set with two young Vietnamese, I believe they were Vietnamese kids. They were decapitated in a John Landis went to court. It was one of the more horrifying stories of all time.
When people say, like, that movie is cursed or something like that.
Yeah, man. It was I wouldn't recommend it, but you can actually go see the original footage of that. And the camera is way far back, so it's not some close-up. But they slow it down, and you can see the helicopter blade coming down and, like, heads popping off.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Again, not recommended. But anyway, Twilight Zone for Brandon, particularly the gremlin on the wing of the plane and John Lithgow segment. I was 7 years old at a friend's house, and it was terrifying. Agreed. Crystal South, the 1972 version of The Last House on the Left, was way too young, and it was horrifying. Yeah, that's not one for the faint of heart. Trish Wallace, Trilogy of Terror. The scene with the knife still makes me uncomfortable. I don't even know what that means, but seen with a knife is all you got to say. Nicole Parks, The Ring, was absolutely the first movie to leave me feeling uneasy afterward.
Agreed.
Yeah.
That was a spooky one.
Yeah, that was a good one, too. And well made, you know?
Oh, big time. I mean, really, really better than the original. I have to say, the American remake was scarier than the original.
Oh, I don't think I saw Ringu.
Yeah, I think the American is better.
Kate Bagat, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I didn't sleep for about a week and kept thinking I saw Leatherface hiding in the bushes. Oh, my dear Lord. I can't imagine. I don't know if I ever have even seen that original movie, come to think of it. Oh, and here we go. Look at this. Joe McCormick and Robert Lamb. That's great. Joe said, I'd like to be able to name a great horror movie, but I think the true answer is probably River of Death, which is an unsanitary canon film slog starring Michael Dudikoff as Jungle Adventure Man, Donald Pleasance as a creepy, soft-spoken Nazi. And then, of course, I printed this out from Facebook, and there's more to it that I can't see.
Yeah, no, but exactly. That's the kind of stuff those dudes are in love with.
Well, Robert said Poltergeist. Watched it way too young and on my aunt's VHS tape. She'd ripped a bunch of films off of HBO, and I think this was one following some cartoons.
That one's got a creepy clown, right?
Isn't there a creepy clown doll
under the bed or something? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a clown doll, which is almost even scarier than a clown. I love that Robert sounds like he was almost duped into watching it after cartoons. And we'll finish up here with Mike Lozar. What's up, Mike? I know Mike. One of the Nightmare on Elm Streets. I can't even say which one. I couldn't go into long, dark hallways without quaking for years afterward. That's right. Because, 1, 2, Freddy's coming for you.
Those little girls. That's the scariest part for me. That stuck with me. When she gets pulled through the... the door, the tiny window at the end.
It was very
girls.
Violent. It wasn't like, it was all herky jerky and like, you knew she shouldn't fit through there.
Yeah, exactly.
It was very creepy. Yeah.
Magical realism is apparently what that is.
Oh, really?
I mean, just the idea of like something that nonsensical happens. Like she didn't explode into like viscera. She just kind of magically popped through there, you know, inexplicably because of the magic of Freddy.
All right, everybody, we're going to move on to a segment of recommended viewing. And as you know, when I do recommended viewing, I do a foreign film, a documentary, and an independent film. And for foreign film, Not Born in the USA, I'm going to go with City of God from 2002, the Brazilian film. It's I think online they classify it as a crime drama, but it's really sort of more like just gritty realism, life on the streets. It tells the story of the rise of crime through about a 20-year period in a housing project in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, you know, the outskirts of Rio. Nominated for 4 Oscars, director, which was and is still pretty unusual for a foreign film to be nominated for Best Director. Cinematography, editing, and adapted screenplay. And it's about as hard-hitting as a movie as you can imagine seeing, and especially for, like, a white suburban dude in Georgia. It was a face punch of reality to what it's like in some parts of the world, compared to the little cushy life that I grew up with. It's one of those good movies to give you some perspective on things. And also just a really well-made, awesome, awesome movie. So City of God, Noel, you've seen that, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's definitely got that gritty realism. It's got a little bit of stylization to it. Like, almost has some of that Tarantino, like, zippy editing or whatever.
Yeah.
But that is not really, like, the feature. It's really just the characters and, like...
Yeah, Rocky.
Yeah. Oh, so good. So, so good. I think he made a multi-part TV miniseries that was kind of based on that later.
Oh, yeah?
Called, I think it's called City of Men or something like that.
I saw something about that. Is that what that is?
I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So I haven't seen that, but I bet it's great.
Got to check that out then. Documentary, I'm going to go with Winnebago Man from 2009, directed by Ben Steinbauer. This is the story of Jack Rebney. And Jack Rebney was a Winnebago salesman in, I wanted to say 80s. I think it's from the 80s or maybe early 90s where he did these local TV commercials. And the way the story goes is someone eventually posted the behind the scenes outtakes of shooting these local TV commercials, selling these Winnebagos onto YouTube. And it became a viral sensation because Jack Rebney was henceforth known as the angriest man alive. The outtakes are all Rebney cursing out the crew, angry about everything from the heat to the flies to the script. And it's really, really funny to see this dude melting down over and over. And I think it's just like a shoot over the course of a couple of days that they culled all these outtakes, right?
I just remember accoutrement.
Accoutrement?
Accoutrement. He has a real problem with that word in the script. It's delightful. And it's a great story. I mean, they've tracked this guy down. He's got a really interesting backstory. It's got a lot of heart to it. Like, it's a great film. And hilarious.
Because he's not the angriest man alive. And he had a lot of issues with the fact that that's what he became known for. But it, we won't give it away, but it kind of comes full circle, like you said, and has a lovely ending, when they finally find him. And of course, since then, the phrase, do me a kindness, has sort of swept the land. I try to work it in. I've said it on Stuff You Should Know before. But instead of like, do me a favor, Jack Rebney said, do me a kindness.
But it's sort of said out of anger. It's sort of like, you know, you are really inconveniencing me. Do me a kindness and quit jerking me around, you know? Like,
so great. Yeah. And definitely, like, even if you can't get Winnebago Man right away, just go to YouTube and type in Jack Rebney, R-E-B-N-E-Y, and just be delighted. And finally, my independent recommendation, which I'm now calling Independence Day.
It's every day, Chuck.
As in D-E-N-T apostrophe S.
Got it. Love it.
It looks more clever on the page. I'm going with All the Real Girls, and I'm just now realizing this is my second recommendation out of two that are independent romance, dramatic romances, because I did Spectacular Now. So I guess I got a thing for that. For Love Stories Told Well. Look at me. Mm. This is from 2003. It was the second movie from David Gordon Green, who wrote and directed it. His first movie, also highly recommend, called George Washington, was his first feature. And he went on, I think his third was called Undertow, which was great. And then there was a fourth that was another kind of gritty indie. And then he improbably dove into comedy in a strange left turn of his career and directed Pineapple Express and The Sitter, that babysitter movie. And it really went kind of wacky, and he started directing all these different kinds of movies. And now David Gordon Green is actually directing the new Halloween movie. Have you heard about that one yet?
I just saw it on Wikipedia just now as I was looking this guy's resume up. Yeah. I'm not familiar with him at all.
Well, the story is, with the new Halloween is Danny McBride, I want to say discovered. He was a friend of his, and Danny McBride was in George Washington and All the Real Girls, and they were his first movies long before he was known as Danny McBride. But Danny McBride co-wrote the new Halloween with him, and what they've done is basically ignored every movie that came after the first Halloween, and this is a direct 40 years later sequel to the first Halloween.
I think ignoring most of those movies is probably a smart choice.
That's the only way to do it.
Although I really like the one that doesn't have Michael Myers in it at all, Season of the Witch. It's really dumb and absurd.
Weird. No one likes that movie.
It's fun. No, you know, Joe and Robert really like it. And it has an amazing John Carpenter-y synth soundtrack, which is my thing.
Sure.
And it's just a dumb, schlocky 70s movie that has nothing to do with Michael Myers, which I just like that. It's very ballsy. I don't know.
Yeah, by the way, everyone, Noel does the music for this show, and I know I say it at the end, but people might not hang around. And I went to Noel at the beginning because I know he's a synth guru and said, hey, I'm kind of looking for something 80s horror movie-ish, John Carpenter. And he just sort of like nodded his head, like, don't you worry.
I'm more of an enthusiast than a guru, Chuck, but you're very kind.
So All the Real Girls, back to that, 2003, second feature film, another romantic drama. It's a story of a guy – future movie crush guest, because I just heard from the great Paul Schneider last night that I booked him for New York City when I go there. Paul is a great dude, and I've gotten to know him a little bit through the years via email and met a couple of times. He came to a Stuff You Should Know show in New York. It's just a great guy. Weirdly, he's probably best known for being on a couple of seasons of Parks and Rec, which there's nothing like TV to put you on the map.
Oh, especially a big hit like that.
I know.
Jumping off the success of The Office, and that show just nailed that tone and kind of took it new places.
Well, I loved Parks and Rec, but Paul is just he's better than that.
Oh, I'm sure. No, but that's where I know him from. But
that sounds mean to say. Parks and Rec was great. I don't want to slag it at all. But he was in one of my other favorite movies, The Assassination of Jesse James. And he's just a really good guy and a great actor.
Cool.
So Paul lives in New York. He's going to be on the show. And he starred in All the Real Girls as a kind of the womanizer, get-around guy in this small southern town with his group of buds, including the aforementioned Danny Masterson and the great, great Shay Whigham, who you probably don't know by name. But if you look up Shay, character actor, he's in a lot of the David Gordon Green movies, and he's just terrific. And Schneider starts dating his friend's younger sister when she comes home from boarding school, who was a very young Zooey Deschanel, one of her first movies, and maybe her first. I'm not quite sure. But obviously this causes friction with the brother and the best friend. And Zooey Deschanel's character is a virgin, and he does not want his womanizing friend dating his younger virgin sister, of course, but they fall in love, and it's like a real romance, and it won the special jury prize at Sundance, and it very much recalls early Terrence Malick, a very poetic, dreamy feel, and at the time, I was like, David Gordon Green, he is the next Terrence Malick, because George Washington had the same feel, and he was clearly influenced by him, and I think Malick even went on to produce one of his next movies. That's why it was so weird to me, when David Gordon Green took all these turns in his career to do wacky comedies and now horror. But, you know, he's branching out. So good for him. It's just a real great romance, a real love story, very realistic, all of the ups and downs and pathos of relationships at that age. Highly recommended. All the Real Girls.
And it's weird. Paul Schneider was also in Lars and the Real Girl.
That's right. He plays the brother,
yeah,
to
Gosling.
What's his face? The most handsome man alive.
Yeah, yeah. Rye. Which the real girl in that one is like a sex doll.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great movie, though.
Oh, yeah, very cool.
We were talking about Anomalisa being so real as a stop motion picture a couple of weeks ago, and Lars and the Real Girl has one of the best love stories, and it's between a guy and a sex doll. Doesn't sound like it would work on paper.
Takes all kinds.
And casting Ryan Gosling, it's like, what? You're going to cast him to play a guy that is removed and can only have a relationship with a blow-up doll? And I say blow-up doll. They aren't blow-up dolls.
They're very expensive, Chuck.
I'm sure they are. All right, so now we move on to our final couple of segments. Stream this. And comment card, which are listener mails. Stream this. I will talk about something that Emily and I have watched lately on TV. And I am going to go with Better Things Season 2. This stars the great Pamela Adlon, who I have the biggest crush on. So does Emily. We both do. She's so wonderful. She writes, she produces, she directed every episode, which again is so rare to see a woman given the reins of a show like this these days. It is a little problematic in that Louis C.K. Started the show with her, and he and Pamela are old friends, and he writes a lot of these episodes and produced the show, but I don't want to hold that against Pamela Adlon, yeah, because she does such a great job on the show, and it would be unfair to say, well, I'm not going to support this because Louis C.K. had his fingerprints on it. You know what I mean?
Such a tough situation with all that stuff.
I know.
Some of it's so cut and dry, but like this conversation of art versus the artists is more front and center now, I think, than it's ever been in my lifetime. For
yeah,
sure.
It's really, really everyone is having to take a good hard look at themselves and the kind of art they support these days. So anyway, Better Things is great. Pamela Adlon is wonderful. It's about a middle-aged actress, a single mother of three girls. Her loony British mom lives across the street, and it's just great. It's funny. It's warm, full of heart, has a message of family overall, warts and all. And that's just my kind of story. I'm such a sucker for these real shows like that, that aren't sappy, but just show the real ins and outs of family life. And she's just so funny. It's great. She was, she played Louis's wife in the original Lucky Louie sitcom, mm-hmm, which was, I thought was great, but it was a weird show for most people.
Yeah, I liked it too. It was a little, the whole laugh track sitcom-y thing was a little off-putting. Yeah. She's, I know her and love her most for being the voice of Bobby Hill on King of the Hill.
Of course. She has a great,
so fun. And
better things, she is largely a voice actor. I mean, it's kind of autobiographical, mm-hmm. largely. But she also, for Say Anything fans, she had a very small part when she was very young as one of John Cusack's buddies. There's that scene in the music store, in the guitar store, where John Cusack is walking around strumming on a Gibson SG, and she plays one of the two girls in there that he's talking about Ione Skye with. That's just a little shout to one of her early cameos. And then she was also on Louis's show as well, playing his good friend and almost love interest over the years. So Pamela Adlon is great. She was nominated for a Golden Globe this year. I really wanted her to win, but she did not. But I can't wait for season 3 of Better Things. Go out and watch it. Highly recommended. And finally, comment card. Gonna go through a couple of listener mails here. This first one is from Buckwheat Young. And Buckwheat, I hope you know I picked you because your name is Buckwheat Young. And I pray that that's your real name and not some weird Facebook thing.
It's a good one.
Hello, Chuck and Noel. I've really been enjoying the new podcast. You said in one of your previous episodes you had a list of potential guests you wanted to have on the show. Do you think you will ever have two guests at once? And who would you like to have as two guests? I'm going to do that, Buckwheat, for sure at some point. I think it makes sense for them to be a couple, not necessarily a romantic or married couple, but just a pair of people. I know one real life couple, the comedian Kurt Brownoler and his wife Lauren Cook are great and wonderful and funny. And Lauren is an actress and has a weekly comedy show she does in L.A., and I know them a little bit, so I would love to get Lauren and Kurt on because they're a lot of fun. They have a podcast called Wedlock that they do together. Cameron Esposito and Rhea Butcher. They are two comedians in Los Angeles, and I know them a little bit as well. And I think they would be fun. And they're both great, but I know Rhea would probably almost certainly pick Back to the Future. So I'd like to have them on. And I have reached out, but I have not heard back from them, which is disappointing. In New York, I talked about Tony Shalhoub. His wife is Brooke Adams from the great movie Days of Heaven, which I probably mentioned a couple of episodes ago. And I don't know if there's a communication breakdown or if I'm just not understanding, but Brooke is also going to be a guest in New York, and I don't know if they're going to do it together or not. They may be deferring to me on that, so maybe I'll get them in there together.
Together can be tough. Holly Fry and I are working on a history of animation show, and we interviewed Seth Green and Matt Seinreich, who are the creators of Robot Chicken.
Yeah.
And they were fantastic, but they couldn't be more different. Seth is just like kind of this like grizzled Hollywood lifer. And Matt Seinreich, who was the editor of Wizard Magazine, is just this ebullient, delightful nerd. And the combo of them was interesting, but it was real easy for Seth to kind of just like plow ahead, you know?
So. Yeah, that's true. He's been at it for a while, man. He was a little brother in Can't Buy Me Love. Shout out to that movie. And then finally, I really, really want to get Georgia and Karen on from My Favorite Murder. I've finally gotten in touch with Georgia after trying all different sorts of ways, because they were coming to Atlanta and I wanted to meet them and talk a little business about some stuff and talk about being on the show. And Georgia finally got in touch with me, and now we are, I have her number and we are texting, and she texted me about 2 hours before their Atlanta show and said, "Hey, do you want to come down here and get on stage and tell, the story of an Atlanta murder that you love?" And I've never wanted to do anything more in my life because I am a legit fanboy of them and that show. But I was at my in-law's house for a birthday celebration, and I was like, "Georgia, you're killing me here with this late notice." And she apologized, and she actually texted back, "Fuck," in all caps, which if you listen to My Favorite Murder, just to get a text from Georgia Hardstark that says "fuck" was a thrill for me.
Of course. Screenshot that shit.
Yeah, I should. So anyway, Georgia and Karen, I'm going to get on, and that would be a murder movie special. And I think that I just can't wait to do that. So I'm going to make that happen. And Ace Gardner says, "Hey guys, enjoy the podcast and the humor and information found therein. And he spelled humor with an O-U-R. So I bet Ace is from the UK. Here's a question for you. We all know how important soundtrack and music in a movie is. What would be your favorite, most notable use of silence? Good question.
That is good.
So I approach this from a couple of angles. One is no dialogue scenes, but maybe there might be some score going on. Mm-hmm. But then there's also times where there's just no sound whatsoever, which is kind of unique. So I have a few examples here. The movie Gravity, which was problematic in some ways for me, but looked so amazing, yeah. Was such a technical achievement that I ended up liking it.
You're anti-3D, right?
Yeah.
Did you see that one in 3D?
No.
It was good.
Yeah.
It made good use of it, I thought. That was one. I am too. I thought that was a rare example of like, okay, 3D works here. They shot it with that in mind.
I could see that. There's not a lot of stuff in that movie. Because that's one of my problems with 3D is just too much confusion.
Like, here's this thing coming at you.
Yeah.
And in that one, it's like everything's floating in space. So kind of everything's coming at you. So,
right. Yeah. But Gravity had a lot of great silent sequences in that movie. Spoiler for the new Star Wars movie.
I was about to say that.
So I'm counting down 3, 2, 1 to give everyone a chance to not listen. The new Star Wars movie to me has one of the greatest all-time uses of silence when Laura Dern, what do you remember the character's name?
I can never remember those Star Wars-y names.
I know. Don't kill us, people. But Laura Dern's character, she gives up her own life in battle with the I keep wanting to say the Empire, but it's the not New Order. That's the band.
It's kind of the New Order.
The First Order.
The First Order. There you go.
And she goes through hyperspace and rips through one of the big ships of the First Order. And Rian Johnson plays that out in complete silence for about 10 or 12 seconds.
To the point where a lot of theaters, I don't know if you saw this, had to put up signs when you're buying your tickets saying, hey, there's a part in this movie that's totally silent. Nothing's wrong. The sound isn't broken.
Yeah, don't get up and go, because it's one of the better scenes. You don't want to get up and run out and say, it's not working.
Yeah.
Really, really great use of silence. And then I'm going to go through a few more here quickly. No Country for Old Men has a lot of great no dialogue sequences in that movie.
It's just the wind on the prairies.
Well, Josh Brolin.
Yeah.
You know, all that stuff in the hotel when he's trying to get the money in the air conditioning vents.
And the tracking thing is
honing
in the whole
beeping,
time.
That's like the only sound.
That's
so good.
So great. That's probably one of my favorite movies of all time, actually.
Oh man, it's so good.
That's an excellent movie.
Did you read the book?
I did not read the book, no.
The book is great, and it's one of those, I know there, we'll handle this question later, but someone did ask about, books being better than movies. And that's an example. Well, we'll just save that.
Yeah.
Silence of the Lambs, the ending. One of the great no dialogue sequences of all time when Jodie Foster is creeping around Buffalo Bill's basement with the night vision goggles. Mm. The end of The Graduate when Benjamin and Elaine run out after he pulls her out of her wedding and run out to the bus. And also one of the most unsettling endings of all time because, you know, The Graduate is such a good movie. It's one of my favorites. And he finally gets Elaine and convinces her to not marry the guy and pulls her out and they get on this bus and they go to the back and they're sitting there and she's in her wedding dress and they laugh for a minute and then they just kind of go deadpan and it's silent and they're not looking at each other and it's what you would think would just be this wonderful happy ending all of a sudden goes to this weird maudlin like, wow, so now we've done this.
Yeah, now what?
Now what? It's so great.
Have you seen Good Time?
Good Time.
It's a recent kind of crime movie directed by the Safdie brothers with Robert Pattinson playing.
Oh, I've heard of that.
It is incredible. And it has this end title sequence where it's just the static shot of one of the main characters just having this dead-eyed, emotive look where he's just dead-eyed and emotive. Those are kind of antithetical. But no, it's just like he's very.
That can be true.
Well, he's kind of crushed, and you're looking at him, and you see so much in his face. And then this amazing Iggy Pop song. The soundtrack is done by this guy, Daniel Lupitin, who's got a project called Onatrix Point Never. And there's a song with Iggy Pop doing this real brooding vocal. And that kind of, it's just Nat sound for a while, and him looking at the camera.
Yeah.
And that song comes on, and the credits roll, and it just keeps holding on this shot of the character. It's just, see that movie.
Yeah, I've heard it's great.
Wonderful movie.
Didn't recognize it by title. And then finally, the beginning of Punch Drunk Love. You heard me talk with Tony Hale on stage about this, but the whole opening sequence of Punch Drunk Love is this great, great silent and no dialogue sequence. Very quiet and well done by P.T. Anderson. So that is it for number three. Thanks, Noel.
Yeah, man. So what's in store for Friday, Chuck?
Friday, heads up, everyone, to watch RoboCop twist your arm, not. Boy, that was a very 80s way to say that. I haven't said not since the 80s.
Let's bring it back. It's all time.
Right. All right, we'll bring that back. Joe Randazzo, my good friend Joe, who used to be editor-in-chief of The Onion, then was the head writer of At Midnight, and now is working on various other projects in Hollywood. Joe is one of my good, good friends. I adore Joe and his family. So this is one of those where it's a close pal, which those are always the best. And Joe picked RoboCop, which is awesome. And I had not seen it, I think, all the way through before, which was remarkably weird. And we talk about that on the show. So brush up so you can crush out on RoboCop for this Friday. Thanks for tuning in this week for Mini Crush number three, and we'll see you all next week.